From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to deal with the human rights abuses of the recent past in Afghanistan and in emerging democracies. We talk with Paul Funsail, Program Director of the Center for Transitional Justice. He was the Executive Secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and testified against former President P.W. Botha. Also, we talk with Leila Ahmed, the first professor of women's studies and religion at Harvard Divinity School. She's the author of a memoir about growing up in Egypt and the book Women and Gender in Islam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Israeli forces moved into Palestinian-run Gaza airport today. The attack follows airstrikes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip in retaliation for a wave of suicide bombings. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says he's declaring war on terror. He's also holding Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat directly responsible for weekend suicide attacks in Israel that left more than 24 people dead. U.S. officials say the Bush administration did not give Israel the go-ahead for today's military attacks in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
State Department spokesman Philip Reker says that Israel did not ask the United States for a green light, and no green light was given. But the Bush administration also has not called on Israel for restraint, as it has following previous Palestinian attacks on Israelis. The State Department spokesman says the weekend attacks were horrendous, heinous, horrific acts of violence. The U.S., he says, understands that Israel must provide for the security of its people. The U.S. is putting great pressure on Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to crack down on the violence, not only by arresting perpetrators, but by dismantling the infrastructure of terrorism. U.S. officials say Arafat must take on militant groups such as Hamas that are believed to sponsor such attacks. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
An Alabama judge is deciding if a former Ku Klux Klansman will stand trial in the 1963 church bombing that killed four African-American girls. The judge had ruled that Bobby Frank Cherry was incompetent to be tried, but a psychologist testified today that Cherry deceived experts who administered a memory test. Melanie Peoples reports.
Experts testified they believe Bobby Frank Cherry is intentionally faking or exaggerating any memory problems he might have as a result of his previously diagnosed vascular dementia. Cherry spent 10 weeks under observation and evaluation in a state mental health facility in order to determine whether he's mentally competent to stand trial in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. Psychologist Kathleen Ronan testified that Cherry appeared to have no memory problems when casually interacting with other patients or staff members, but that under formal testing or observation, his problems were numerous. Defense attorneys have said Cherry fails to meet the Alabama legal standard of competency because he can neither remember events from 1963, nor can he assist in his defense. However, psychologists say Cherry can remember 1963 and that he also understands the legal issues surrounding his case. For NPR News, I'm Melanie Peoples in Birmingham.
Employees of collapsed energy trader Enron Corporation left the company's headquarters in Houston early today. They were sent home to await layoff notices. Spokesman Mark Palmer said the company's planning the job cuts as part of a drastic cost reduction campaign in the wake of its record bankruptcy filing yesterday. Stock prices were generally lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 87 points to 97.63. The Nasdaq was down 25. The S&P 500 dropped about 9. This is NPR News. The administration today issued its third general alert since September 11th. Warning that the threat of a terrorist attack remains high. Officials said they were being especially cautious because of the number of religious observances this month, such as Ramadan. NPR's Pam Fessler reports from the White House.
The FBI issued the warning this afternoon to 18,000 local law enforcement officials. White House Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge said the alert was the result of an increased volume of general terrorist threats picked up by law enforcement and intelligence agencies over the past several days.
The threats we are picking up are very generic. They warn of more attacks, but are not specific about where or what type.
The administration has been criticized for issuing such vague warnings in the past, but Ridge said it was important to remind Americans that the nation's still at war and that they should be vigilant. Ridge said people should still go about their daily activities. Some officials worry that the alerts could hurt the economy by encouraging people to stay home. Pam Fessler, NPR News, the White House.
Attorney General John Ashcroft says the U.S. and Canada will stand together against terrorism to make the continent a safer place. He says the countries have agreed on a new deal to bolster security along thousands of miles of border they share. But Ashcroft says the estimated $1.3 billion of daily cross-border trade will not be disrupted. Canadian and U.S. officials say they'll work to streamline inspections and security so trade is not hampered. A Los Angeles judge today refused to allow Sarah Jane Olson to withdraw her guilty plea in a Symbionese Liberation Army bomb plot. Superior Court Judge Larry Fidler said, quote, she pled guilty because she is guilty. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from BookSense, featuring You Read to Me and I'll Read to You by Janet Schulman, published by Knopf, at independent bookstores with BookSense or at BookSense.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As Afghanistan makes its transition to a post-Taliban government, it will have to decide how to deal with the atrocities and human rights abuses of the past few years. My guest Paul Funsail is helping with that process. He's the program director of the International Center for Transitional Justice, which is headquartered in New York. Funsail is a lawyer from South Africa. At the age of 25, he was the executive secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and was the main witness in the trial against former President P.W. Botha. His job now is to help emerging democracies develop ways of dealing with the human rights abuses of past regimes. This can range from prosecuting individual perpetrators to trading amnesty for confessions about torture, murder, and other state-sponsored violence. Truth commissions can gather the stories of victims so that victims are heard and their suffering is acknowledged. Funsail thinks this kind of truth-telling would be helpful for those who were victimized by the Taliban.
Well, I think that one of the ways in which repressive rule is sustained and atrocious human rights abuse is perpetuated is by hiding from the public the real human consequences of that abuse. I think many people can drum up a range of ideological justifications for human rights abuse, but when they're confronted with an ordinary person telling their story of unspeakable acts of torture or terrible systemic human rights abuse of the type experienced by the woman in Afghanistan, people begin to find that intolerable because it's so difficult to defend the level of deprivation, the denial of basic rights. And I think by placing those stories in the public discourse, we can't help but be moved by them. We can't help but be reviled and object to that form of treatment. And I think that that's extraordinarily important. Human rights abuse thrives when you have a culture of silence which conceals it. And it becomes much more difficult to conduct abusive policies when it's brought out into the open.
I imagine for a lot of people, if they publicly tell their stories, particularly in an official setting, that then they want some kind of justice. They want to know that the person responsible for their suffering is going to be punished for it, that there'll be some justice. Do you think it's important to have that kind of follow-through afterwards?
I think it's certainly that any process of dealing with mass atrocity and systemic human rights abuse must attempt to incorporate some element of justice and prosecution. And that's a cardinal principle and one that I think we should always try and achieve. I think there are two important caveats to that. Firstly, victims are as complex and diverse as any other group of human beings. And therefore, stemming from my experience at the South African Truth Commission, I was profoundly moved by the wide range of responses that victims had to atrocity. Certainly, some wanted justice. In fact, some wanted revenge. They wanted to be able to personally revenge themselves upon those people responsible for abuse. Other people just wanted the truth. Others wanted an apology. Others wanted to discover the fate and the whereabouts of their loved ones. some mothers just wanted the red sweater that their son was wearing the day he disappeared, and that's all they wanted. So I think that it's important to listen to victims because they have a range of different expectations. Having said that, it's also important to look at what your country can reasonably achieve. Often societies emerging from mass atrocity have weak judicial systems, and their capacity to prosecute hundreds, if not thousands, of perpetrators is often very limited. So we have to tailor our justice policies in such a way that they are realistic, that they don't raise unrealistic expectations amongst survivor communities.
What's your analysis so far about Afghanistan and the ability there to prosecute the people who are responsible for state-sponsored human rights abuses?
I think there are significant challenges in Afghanistan in that regard. Firstly, the process of establishing a broad-based, inclusive, multi-ethnic government in Afghanistan is going to be complicated by the almost certain inclusion in that government of some people who have less than stellar human rights track records. And therefore, if one is going to call upon that government to prosecute people responsible for human rights abuse, one has to recognize that there may be a limited appetite for that amongst some people in that government.
Well, and let me see if I understand what you're saying, that some of the warlords who were in power before the Taliban might be in power again after the Taliban, and some of their records were pretty bad in terms of human rights. So these are the people you're talking about who might be in power after the Taliban, and how can you prosecute the Taliban and let the new leader's human rights abuses go unremarked?
Absolutely. I think that there's people who themselves have bad human rights track records are often fairly reluctant to embark on either wide-scale inquiries about human rights abuse or a robust series of prosecutions for fear of where they may eventually land up and who they might point a finger towards. I also think that notwithstanding the very encouraging developments about the treatment of women and the relative position of women in Afghanistan, I think there is still a rather powerful residual block of people who are fairly weak on women's rights, to say the least. And therefore, any attempt to deal with the terrible crimes committed against women might run into some form of political resistance from the new government as well.
Well, the crimes committed against women range from execution to just forcing all women to wear burqas and to not work, to have just profoundly restricted lives. Do you think something like forcing women to wear a burqa is something that a Truth and Reconciliation Commission should contend with or would be able to contend with? It's such a widespread form of discrimination or abuse.
Well, I think that's why a truth commission would in fact be an interesting idea in Afghanistan, because it will be able to deal with the real full range and the complexity of the different modes of human rights abuse which occurred in Afghanistan. You wouldn't be able to prosecute somebody in a court of law for forcing a woman to wear a burqa, but I suspect that you may be able to elicit from women their views on that experience. And there may be a complex set of views about that. I suspect that many people's instinctual response will be deep resentment at having such a ritual imposed upon them, as opposed to them having allowing to embark on such a ritual based on their own free choice. But I think that that's, you know, at one end of the scale, the denial of healthcare, the denial of education, the denial of the ability to work for a whole category of educated, sophisticated women of Afghanistan, I think is a form of abuse and a form of denial which demands airing, and those stories should be told. And I think those stories will be very useful, not just for Afghanistan, but for all of Islam, because I think what's at stake here is a broader question about the role of women in Islam in general. And by providing articulate, capable women who have suffered this form of abuse with a platform to tell their stories, that might embolden women throughout the Islamic world who are fervent believers in Islam, who believe it to be an important progressive great world religion, but who are firmly opposed to some of the more patriarchal tendencies within it, to be able to gain a platform. And I think that could be truly transformative.
You've said that you're opposed to acts of vengeance. Where do you draw the line between vengeance and justice?
Well, I think that justice is something which occurs within the framework of the rule of law. It is an instrument that where we bring to bear rules that we as a society have agreed upon. We bring those to bear against people who have violated those rules. We do so in a fair way, in a dispassionate way. We build in sufficient due process guarantees so that we aren't perpetrating an injustice ourselves in seeking to pursue justice. Why I'm opposed to vengeance is, firstly, because vengeance almost always happens outside of the framework of the rule of law, and therefore very often or runs the inherent risk in targeting those people who are innocent. But secondly, I think it's an unproductive mode of dealing with the past because it leads often to recriminations and reprisals and increases the cycle of violence. And what we're seeking to do in so many of the societies in which we work is break that cycle of violence and replace it with a new mode of governance and a new mode of dealing with disagreement, where people can disagree within a democratic framework as opposed to having to resort to violence.
You've said that people have come to the realization that unless you develop sophisticated strategies to deal with the past, it comes back to haunt you. Have you seen examples of that?
Well, in almost every country in which we work, those countries which have sought to bury the past and not deal with it, take Chile, for example, where the outgoing Pinochet regime secured for themselves a blanket amnesty, really threatened the new democratic forces that the only way to ensure a return to democratic rule in Chile was to provide General Pinochet and the armed forces with a fairly broad and comprehensive amnesty. And in the course of that, they thought that they had bought a social peace and stability. 10 years later, 15 years later, the question of Pinochet looms large over Chile, the arrest in Britain and the subsequent debate that caused really did poison relations in Chile. And it's only by, in fact, confronting that legacy of abuse that I think the Chileans have managed to move on. And unless you develop proactive strategies to deal with the past, the past comes back to haunt you on its own terms, not on terms of your choosing. And that almost invariably means that the past is dealt with in a less healthy and a less constructive way and in a way that's more damaging and destabilizing.
My guest is Paul Funsail, Program Director for the International Center for Transitional Justice. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Funsail. He's Program Director for the International Center for Transitional Justice, which is consulting to many countries, including Afghanistan. He's a South African lawyer who, at the age of 25, was the Executive Secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The commission began in 1995. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is where you got your first experience with this kind of transitional justice, that commission gave amnesty to many perpetrators of crimes in return for their confessions to those crimes, basically traded truth for amnesty. Looking back, do you think that that's been effective in helping to heal the country? Or do you think it's created a lot of resentment that some people who confess to terrible human rights abuses are now free and comfortable?
You know, Winston Churchill once said that democracy is the worst form for all governments except all others. And I often think that the South African Truth Commission was one of the worst ways to come to terms with our past except all others. And by that I mean, at its very core was a series of very, very difficult and heart-wrenching trade-offs that you had to say, well, in order for this country to move forward to democracy, in order for a very powerful white regime to be incentivized to relinquish power and hand over to a democratic government, there was going to have to be an amnesty arrangement. They insisted upon an amnesty arrangement, and Nelson Mandela and the leaders of the liberation movement appreciated that it would be very difficult to secure that transition without amnesty. And in that context, what we could have done is simply say, all right, there's an amnesty for human rights abuse in South Africa. That's a political fact. Let's move on. Let's think about economic growth. Let's think about tourism. Let's not look at the human rights abuse that occurred during apartheid. And I think there was a wise determination amongst the political leadership and amongst human rights organizations that that would be profoundly unproductive for South Africa. And so coupled with the political reality of an amnesty was a truth-seeking process which sought to uncover the full extent of human rights abuse that occurred in South Africa. And I think that we succeeded, by and large, in discovering who was responsible for human rights abuse, who were the victims, who at the highest levels of government gave the orders. We discovered where victims who had been disappeared, whose bodies had been burnt and thrown into rivers. We discovered the fate of victims. And we prompted, over a period of 3 years, a real deep introspective soul-searching on behalf of all South Africans. That truth and that transition to democracy came at a terrible price, and the terrible price was the granting of amnesty to people responsible for horrendous crimes. If we could have had it any other way, I think we should have tried to avoid the amnesty. I'm not sure in the South African context that that amnesty could have been avoided. And therefore, I think the Truth Commission was a necessary and important supplement which gave victims a voice and which foregrounded human rights abuse.
Are most of the people who confessed to human rights abuses at the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, are they now outcasts, or are many of them still holding important positions?
The majority of people who admitted to acts of torture and murder and other gross violations of human rights abuse have retired from their positions in government or in the police force or in the security force and no longer occupy prominent positions of power and status in South Africa. The sheer social stigmatization that occurred as a result of having, in the full glare of television cameras, having to confess, having tortured people and having poisoned people and having committed other horrendous crimes, really reduced people's capacity to play leading and influential roles in our society. They still live off handsome pensions. They aren't sitting in jail as they should be. But I think their capacity to influence present policy has been significantly, if not totally, diminished.
Are you recommending to many countries now that they don't give amnesty?
I think it's one of our strongest policy prescriptions in the work that we do around the world is that amnesties really should be avoided at almost all costs. Amnesties are profoundly unhealthy. They undermine the rule of law. They breed cynicism. They're an insult to victims of human rights abuse. And I think as a real principle, one wants to try and oppose amnesties at almost any cost. At the same time, there are those societies in which people responsible for abuse still hold tremendous power and influence. And one has to then think very carefully about how it is that such persons can be incentivized to leave office or relinquish power and turn power over to democratic forces. And so I think one must be careful not to be too doctrinaire and too rigid in the real world, because one can firstly subvert the will of the majority of people in a particular country if it is their determination. Let me give you an example, Burma. In Burma, you have a very powerful regime with one of the largest per capita militaries in the world, and you have no real prospect, no realistic prospect that democratic forces will be able to reacquire power other than through a process of negotiation. And it's going to be very difficult to get the Burmese regime to leave power without making some painful compromises. Now, Aung San Suu Kyi, Nobel Peace Prize winner and a woman of great moral integrity, has recently been arguing that there may have to be some form of amnesty in Burma in order for the military to be incentivized to leave power. Would I stand in judgment on Aung San Suu Kyi and say that what she is suggesting is unprincipled and immoral? I think that would be unprincipled and immoral. At the same time, I think one can provide people like Aung San Suu Kyi and the Burmese opposition movement with a rich array of comparative experience of how other societies have sought to achieve transition without necessarily giving an amnesty, how they've sought to balance the real politic of having to deal with powerful people on the one hand with a range of creative strategies on the other hand, which preserve the possibility of accountability at some point.
Paul Funsail is the program director for the International Center for Transitional Justice, which is headquartered in New York. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Paul Funsail talks about testifying against former South African President P.W. Botha when Funsail worked on South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And we talk with Leila Ahmed, the author of Women and Gender in Islam, and a memoir about growing up in Egypt. Ooh. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Paul Funsail. He's the program director for the International Center for Transitional Justice, which helps emerging democracies develop systems for dealing with state-sponsored violence of the recent past. Funsail was the executive secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. When you were the secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you were the main state witness in a trial against former President P.W. Botha. He was on trial for committing atrocities carried out by government security forces. How did you end up being the main witness?
I was due to question P.W. Botha when he was subpoenaed to appear before the Truth Commission. And we subpoenaed him to appear before the Truth Commission, but he declined to appear. So he was prosecuted, and this is ironic, not for the horrendous crimes that he had alleged to have committed, but for the rather technical accusation of failing to respond to a subpoena issued by the Truth Commission. My role as the chief state witness was to set out the case against P.W. Botha, all the evidence that we had collected during the work of the Truth Commission, which tended to indicate that he was responsible for gross violations of human rights, and on that basis to provide the court with the basis upon which we wished to question him, to say, look, here is this horrendous record of the apartheid regime. Here's a man who sat at the pinnacle of the apartheid regime. We want to question him, and he refuses to be questioned, and that should be rightly condemned as a violation of the law.
What was the outcome?
He was convicted at the first instance, and then
convicted of refusing to show up?
Correct. And then he was acquitted on a very narrow technical point before a court of appeal. But I think, as Archbishop Tutu said, the process of having him prosecuted was he got his comeuppance, as the Archbishop said. Firstly, because he appeared before a black magistrate, which was exquisitely ironic, that here was the leader of the apartheid regime having to appear in the dock before a black magistrate, a man who he had previously denied some of the most fundamental rights. And secondly, we were provided, the Truth Commission was provided with an opportunity, and I testified for over 2.5 days, to set out the case against him. And that case was reported extensively in the media, and that case essentially went unanswered because had he appeared before the Truth Commission, he would have had an opportunity to respond to our questions. But since he was being prosecuted in a court of law, he had no opportunity to do so. So I think it was a very damaging for his reputation. And I think it reveals the real price of the arrogance of undemocratic leaders who believe that they should never have to answer any questions about their conduct, regardless of the consequences of that conduct.
What was it like for you at the age of 25 to be the main witness against the former president of your country, a president who ruled over the country during apartheid?
It was fairly nerve-wracking, to tell you the truth. I went the day before the trial started, I went bungee jumping because I thought that I should try and submit myself to the most terrifying experience I could possibly subject myself to. And after that, it would be a piece of cake. Strangely enough, I prepared harder for that those 2 days of testimony than I had for almost anything else prior to that. And so when I finally took the stand, I felt very calm and very confident. And I also was cognizant of the enormous responsibility in presenting a case in a calm way, in a way that was unbiased, that didn't seem as though we were out to get him, but to really let the facts speak for themselves. And it was interesting. On the first day that he arrived in court, as he walked into court, even though he was the accused, the entire court rose and got to their feet, which tells you something, including black people who were in the court, which tells you something about the psychology of power. But by the end of the trial, he wandered in and out like a really almost insignificant old man. I think his reputation had been very severely tarnished, and he had been unmasked for what he was and for what his regime was. And I consider that to be extraordinarily important.
Did he stare at you while you were giving your testimony?
He stared fairly ferociously, and I think he was particularly angry that I was somebody who was had an Afrikaans last name and seemed to come from the Afrikaans community, which was a community that he regarded as unflinchingly loyal to the apartheid regime. And so I think he was doubly angry and regarded it as an act of betrayal that somebody who was both white and had an Afrikaans last name would testify against him.
Was it hard for you to not get emotional while you were making your presentation?
I obviously wanted to get emotional because I given my experience, I have colleagues who I worked with in the student movement who were assassinated. I have a professor at my university who was a friend of the family was assassinated. I've seen firsthand the real consequences of human rights abuse in South Africa, and therefore, when you're testifying about the conduct of the former head of that government, it's not just about a narrow assembling of technical facts. It's about blood and guts. It's about people's lives, and so it's there was a very strong impulse to be emotional. Before I testified, Archbishop Tutu's press secretary, a man by the name of John Allen, who I respect enormously, I think stressed the importance of not allowing this to appear as though the Truth Commission was a body staffed by emotional hotheads who had preconceived ideas, that we were sober-minded, that we were serious, that we took our responsibility enormously importantly. And so I think that caused me on many occasions not to rise to the bait and not to become angry, especially in the face of some rather searing cross-examination where I might have done otherwise if I was in a conversation in a bar or at a party.
My guest is Paul Funsail, Program Director for the International Center for Transitional Justice. He was the Executive Secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Paul Funsail, Program Director for the International Center for Transitional Justice. He was the Executive Secretary of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What are some of the mistakes that you've learned from the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission or from other truth commissions that you've worked with in other countries, mistakes that you're applying now to the countries that you're working with? Mistakes you're learning from is what what I meant to say.
Right. The first mistake is not to presume that a truth commission is appropriate in every context. And I think there are a range of settings where a truth commission is not appropriate and not helpful. And
An example?
Well, for example, there is some debate right now, for example, in Mexico, about whether it would be useful to have a commission, partly because I think many people believe that prosecutions should take precedence. I happen to believe in the Mexican context it would be incredibly important to have a commission, but one has to listen carefully to those who say we shouldn't allow a truth commission to be established as a substitute for some form of criminal prosecution for those people responsible for torture or those people responsible, for example, for the recent death of Digna Ochoa, very prominent Mexican human rights lawyer and activist. So I think the first thing is to say that truth commissions should never be introduced into a country as an SOP for justice, to say, here, we're introducing a truth commission because truth commissions are the soft option. They're appealing, they're telegenic, and they avoid the very hard questions that prosecutions might. These things ought to be run together, and they ought to be complementary.
Other mistakes you've learned from?
I think sometimes you have to be cognizant of questions of culture, that it's interesting that in many of the countries where truth commissions have been most successful, there have been strong elements of a Christian underpinning. And what some people have argued is that the mode of inquiry and public disclosure and confession and repentance lends itself to a cultural or religious context that is primarily Christian. Now, I'm very wary of those kinds of generalizations, and I think that you get yourself into all sorts of trouble when you make those kinds of sweeping statements. I think there are a range of primarily Christian countries which have been appalling at looking at their past. But I use that example because I think it's important to be very, very sensitive to local cultural practices, local cultural traditions, and to formulate your strategies for dealing with the past in a way that doesn't impose a blueprint taken from one society and simply impose it on another society.
You have participated in Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in several countries, very actively in South Africa. How do you prevent yourself by being totally overwhelmed by the inhumanity that people are capable of? And how do you prevent yourself from just being incredibly pessimistic and cynical about human beings?
Well, actually, I think that most of the Truth Commission experiences that I've witnessed or participated in have actually made me profoundly optimistic about human beings in a paradoxical kind of way. Firstly, because they've illustrated our enormous power to transcend adversity. People who have suffered unspeakable suffering have been able to emerge stronger, have been able to testify with a great sense of dignity and composure, and who have been able to survive. And so I constantly marvel at the sheer strength of people and their capacity to carry on. I also think that truth commissions have a capacity to be profoundly transformative, that when a nation engages in a deep and genuine and profound act of soul searching, it has the capacity to change that nation, to change its cultural practices, to change its institutions, to change the way the police do business, the way the intelligence organizations collect information, the way the legal profession is practiced. And that capacity for transformation, I think, is incredibly inspiring, because you can do one of two things when you confront mass atrocity. You can wash your hands and shrug your shoulders and say, this country is desperate and hopeless. Or you can say, step by step, inch by inch, we are going to try and rebuild the society and assist in the rebuilding of the society. And that's about optimism. That's not about pessimism.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Paul Funsail is the program director for the International Center for Transitional Justice, which is based in New York. My guest, Leila Ahmed, is the first professor of women's studies in religion at Harvard Divinity School. She's also the author of the book Women and Gender in Islam. In her memoir, A Border Passage from Cairo to America, she writes about being a Muslim and feminist. She was born in Cairo in 1940 and grew up in an educated, prosperous family. Her parents sent her to English-speaking schools in Egypt and to college in England. Her father chaired the Nile Water Control Board. After the revolution in 1952, when Nasser assumed power, her family's status changed. Nasser decided to go forward with the Aswan Dam, which her father opposed for environmental reasons. As a result, he lost his job and was censored. Soon after, her family's values were no longer considered in sync with Egypt, which had begun to turn against the West. Ahmet says her Western education began to be considered suspect. She became embarrassed to speak English. I asked her about the early expressions of extremism she saw in Egypt in the 1950s.
It was mostly in the form of Arab nationalism. We began to be kind of bludgeoned by the notion that we were Arab. And this came as a bit of a surprise. Well, not, I mean, in retrospectively, I know it was a surprise to me, because, but I didn't quite understand it then, because I had grown up understanding that we were Egyptian, and now to be Arab was somehow more true and more important. And by reading history, I came to understand that to be Egyptian meant to be multi-religious and multi-ethnic. That was the kind of country they were trying to construct at that point in history. So the insistence was that Copts and Muslims and Jews and the people who made up the population of Egypt, in fact, at that point, were all Egyptian. And so the pluralism of Egypt was enormously emphasized. Whereas once we became Arab, which happened in 52 with Nasser's revolution, being Arab, being tied to the Arab nations became paramount. Our identity as Arabs, and implicitly but not explicitly as Muslims, was paramount. And so people who were not Arab or Muslim in some sense, in other words, the Copts of Egypt and the Jews of Egypt, were not quite part of the identity. And I think it's not coincidence that this followed the war with Israel in 48, and it was a redefining of the identity of Egyptians to fit an anti-Israeli stance and a pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian stance.
Did you have friends who were changing, friends who were starting to practice a more radical form of Islam, or friends who were becoming Arab extremists?
No, I didn't, actually. Much later, I would have friends who would join, relatives and friends, actually, who would not, I wouldn't say would join fundamentalism, but, for instance, they started wearing the hijab, you know, the headscarf, the Muslim headscarf. I don't think they became fundamentalists in any sense of violent people, but they or even extremists, but they came to believe that that is what Islam required of them.
And were you able to understand that? It's obviously something that you did not believe.
No. Well, I mean, it's what I study, you know. So no, I do have to understand it, and thank goodness I think I am able to understand it. It's, I mean, I hear it now from many of my students who might wear scarf or hijab, and they do so, obviously. Essentially because they believe that the Quran or Islam requires that, but also because among their critiques is that people of my generation accepted the Western notion of the veil as oppressive, and that in fact Western dress, miniskirts, corset, high heels, all of those things are actually much more damaging and at least the sexist. So I do understand, and I think their critique sometimes makes sense.
What kind of Islam were you brought up with?
How do I speak of this? It was, the easiest way to speak of it. It was a very kind of mystical, personal sense of Islam, a very pacifist kind of Islam, that really was based on. I mean, I use the term in my memoir that it is a women's Islam, but women is in quotes, because I think it's the Islam of the non-highly literate people. It's an Islam that's based not on studying books and texts, but on just listening to the Quran. And, of course, there is a huge tradition, and it's a very old tradition, of the Quran being above all an oral text, a text that you listen to. Listen to the recitation, and the recitation can be very beautiful. And if you listen to it, what remains at the end is really its recurring themes, and its and these are inescapably its emphasis on peace and justice and mercy and compassion, and those kinds of things. So, and I think that's what ordinary people take away from it, and feel that this is how they. These are the qualities that should be pervading their lives. So I think that's the Islam that is the Islam that I grew up with. grew up believing to be Islam.
My guest is Leila Ahmed, author of the memoir A Border Passage from Cairo to America, A Woman's Journey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Leila Ahmed, the first professor of women's studies and religion at Harvard Divinity School. She writes about growing up in Egypt and being a Muslim and feminist in her memoir, A Border Passage. In your memoir, you write that there was a period when you were craving religious faith and you were considering converting from Islam to Christianity. Why were you considering conversion?
It was a time of enormous both loss and difficulty for me, and I didn't quite know where to turn. You know, I grew up in a place where, I don't know how to describe it exactly. Faith wasn't something that you practice. It was just there in the air, you know, so that if some tragedy befell people, everyone around you would be thinking about it in what now I would call religious terms, in that they would think about it as, I think the basic issue is that their attitude was that life was meaningful, and somehow this had something to do with God. So when things happened, then you reflected on what happened, and it was within a context which gave meaning to all of life. And when I was in England, I was without this community, of course, and it was also a very secular world in which the assumption was that anyone who believed in God was really not quite as smart as people who didn't. And then when I went through, well, I lost both my parents and my own health was uncertain. I really felt a total loss and deeply needed something that acknowledged meaning as actually central to life. So I think that was what it was about.
Yet you didn't convert.
I didn't convert, no.
What did you think would change for you if you did convert from Islam to Christianity? What did you, at that time in your life, think you might find in Christianity that you weren't finding in Islam?
A feeling of total faith. And I guess at that point, it must mean that I wasn't able to find it. And I thought perhaps... But you know, I'm hesitating as I'm answering you, because what I understand now is also that I was living in a country where there were very few people who were Muslim or anything else other than Christian, actually. And of course, I'd grown up in a colonial situation in which what white people did and what perhaps Christians did was implicitly superior. So maybe that was an element of why I went through that crisis.
Do you consider yourself observant of the Islamic faith? I'm asking that because I've met many religion scholars over the years who are deeply committed to spending their lives immersed in religion, but more immersed in studying its history than in actually practicing it, because they've had problems with organized religion and problems with the way the religion has been interpreted. But they want to spend their lives immersed in thinking about religion, if not in actually observing and practicing it.
Part of what I do when I hear things, sometimes I translate them in my mind and imagine myself asking my mother this or my grandmother. And neither of them would even understand the question, because to be Muslim, what that meant was a way of being. It didn't mean I necessarily believe in this or that exactly, but it means I live in this way and I have these values. So it's not exactly translatable as observant or practicing. It's about something much more diffuse and much more embodied than a belief, which is a very intellectual thing.
You write in your memoir that there are large numbers of Muslims who have never lived in a land in which freedom of thought and religion were the accepted norm. And the way in which that's changed now, you say, is that tens of thousands of Muslims are living in Europe and in the United States where there is freedom of thought and religion. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that and what impact you think it's had on Islam to have so many Islamic countries run by dictators.
Well, it's had a huge impact, but not only by dictators, because dictators is a modern term, but I mean throughout history, what religion means, what Islam means, has been constructed in a particular way, and it's connected with state power and the power to dictate what people are supposed to believe. And if you don't, you're in very serious trouble. So it goes all the way back, and it, of course, runs into the present day. Many of the Sufi thinkers, for example, were considered heretical. Some were executed. So it's a very fundamental thing that that people have done without. And I guess that partly relates to the whole issue of practice in a way, because practicing or being observant implies somehow some public demonstration or public way of being religious, whereas I think for many Muslims, how you feel about your religion is a very private matter because the state has been so tyrannical. So to finally be able to actually write and speak about what you believe is a huge, huge thing which we actually haven't entirely crossed yet, because we know of Muslim writers who get threatened for saying what they think, you know.
Leila Ahmed is the author of A Border Passage from Cairo to America, A Woman's Journey. She's a professor of women's studies and religion at Harvard Divinity School. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Amy Sallet, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Fiery Cross, a novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of The Outlander Saga. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Someday I'll have me a chauffeur and a block-long limousine, EO11.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the original Ocean's 11 with Angie Dickinson. She starred in the film with the Rat Pack. And we talk with Gerald Early, editor of the Sammy Davis Jr. Reader. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.